You can keep up with all the episodes of the Journalism Salute by checking out our newsletter. The link is at the bottom of the show notes. Hope you'll subscribe. And let us know where you're listening from and what you think of the podcast. Email us at journalismsalute@gmail.com. Thank you. Hi and welcome to the Journalism Salute. I'm Mark Simon. In each episode, we'll talk to or about an interesting person or organization related to journalism. The intent is to show that journalists are not the enemy of the people. Thank you for listening. On this episode, we're joined by Aaron Reed. Aaron is an independent journalist who covers transgender issues and anti-transgender legislation for her newsletter, Aaron in the Morning, available on Substack. She also does video reporting on Instagram and TikTok. Aaron is transgender, uses the pronouns she, her, and is based in Maryland. She's originally from Louisiana and has a degree from Louisiana Tech with a master's at LSU. Hi, Aaron. Thanks for joining me.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me on.
So the first thing we ask everyone that we have on is the same question. What is your journalism origin story?
Of course. So mine is a little bit unique. You know, I didn't come here from a standard background in order to get to where I'm going. Prior to working here, I did a little bit of statistics work in election prediction, and I did work at the American Independent, which was a journalistic outlet, but I was not a journalist there. I was the digital director. I managed a lot of the online operations. I ended up working at an advertising firm for 2 years. And so none of my professional background is in like reporting or writing or anything like that. But after I transitioned 5 years ago, I became very aware that the healthcare resources were hard to find for trans people. And so I sought out to make a map of them. I mapped out all of the hormone therapy clinics for my community. And as I did that, people continued to sort of follow me for my medical reporting, for my getting information about where to get your care at. And that just sort of grew and ballooned outwardly until I finally became sort of unwittingly a central source for information about healthcare access. And very naturally, right after that, we started seeing laws that target trans healthcare. And so I found myself very quickly having to pivot and talk about, okay, so I've tracked all these clinics. Now there are laws that might endanger them. I listened to the hearings. I developed relationships with activists in every state. I ended up, you know, making friends with parents of trans youth in many of these states. And, you know, anytime there was a major event on this issue, like chances were I knew who it was that was going through it, or I knew the clinic director. I knew one of the legislators. So starting, you know, over the last 3 years or so, I began doing this a little bit more methodically. I learned how to operate legislative tracking tools. I learned how to read bills alongside, you know, people who do this for a living. And I became the first person to break news on, like, here's a new bill that dropped, here's what it does, here's how it might affect you, and here's how you report on this. And then starting in November, or actually October of 2022, I saw what had just happened in 2022, the 250 bills that targeted the community. And I saw 2023 was likely going to be a hard year. And so I left my job. It was an advertising job. I stepped out. I only had 2 months savings to my name. I had never written an article. Basically, well, I'd written a couple articles, but like did not do this for a living in any time in my life. And I opened a Substack newsletter and I said, you know, I'm going to try to either start an organization or just report on this. And I started writing, and very quickly, people started just subscribing. They wanted to hear what I had to say. And it just, thankfully, it became a way that I could reach a ton of people.
Were you, like, when it started to happen, were you kind of overwhelmed by the response?
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, prior to that, like I was still doing reporting. I was still breaking news often. I broke, for instance, some of the Texas Ken Paxton, Attorney General Ken Paxton, Greg Abbott in 2022. He was investigating parents of trans youth for child abuse. And I was one of the first people to break that information. So I was definitely in the mindset of people rely on me for information before I entered into this. But I did not know that, like, long form content, that writing articles would be something that people would follow me for, because up until that point, everybody who relied on me for information was relying on me for very short tweets or for videos that I was putting on TikTok. That was not the case though. You know, whenever I started seeing people subscribe, I realized that I was occupying a space that really very few other people were occupying.
Yeah, for sure. And like we talk about market inefficiencies in journalism, and this you came right into one. I do ask one other question about background, and that's, is there anything in your family or heritage that has any relationship to journalism? Are there any storytellers in the family or anything like that?
You know, that's really interesting. I am a first-generation college graduate, so nobody in my family or extended family had graduated college prior to that. And, you know, family, for me, I grew up in South Louisiana. I grew up in the swamps of South Louisiana, the far south of New Orleans, you know, whenever I was young and growing up in that area. I felt very disconnected in a lot of ways from society because of the fact that you are kind of isolated. However, from a very early age, I was able to get, you know, a 56K dial-up modem. And I, you know, even back then, I remember very much like trying to learn about the world out there, trying to learn about the world that was outside of, you know, my little local bubble in Louisiana. And so while I may not have had the storytellers in my family per se, like the people who do this work per se, I think growing up, I saw that there were stories that were being told that I connected with so strongly. And that was actually, you know, back whenever I was 11 or 12 years old, that was whenever I first came out to a select group of friends, mainly friends that I had made online. We had a little Dungeons and Dragons group that we played back then. And that was my first safe space. That was my first space where I could tell people who I was. And I think that, you know, fast forward 25 years and I'm in this role now to where I can speak to people. And I think that in my mind, I tell the stories that nobody else is telling, that the people like me, whenever I was younger, I wish I could have heard.
And one example of that, I want to go through a couple of examples of stories. One that kind of got me when I was reading, put a real human face to this. February 16th, you wrote about a girl and her mom in Georgia who were at the state house to meet with state legislators. The girl was 8, is transgender. They're waiting to meet, and a Republican state senator comes down the hall. He stops, talks to the family, not realizing what they're doing there, even though they're holding up signs that would indicate what they were doing there. Mid-conversation, the senator finds out that she's transgender, and he gets the heck out. That's a great story. It was amazing. How did you find out about it?
Yeah, so I had just been talking to some activists in Georgia who were letting me know about a bill. It had nothing to do with that incident. And they were letting me know that, hey, there's this new bill that's coming out. It's a Don't Say Gay bill in Georgia. And nobody's really reporting on this right now. We need some help just like letting people know that this is happening. And so I spoke on the phone with the person who had given me information about this bill. And they had been active in several lobbying meetings. And they said, you know, there was something that happened in one of the lobbying meetings where one of the senators had knelt down and told one of the girls that he would protect them. And come to find out, it was a trans girl. And the mom was like yelling after him as he was running away after he learned. And so I got in touch with she put me in touch with the mom. And I knew from an incident, like, this is, like the headline popped into my head. And like, you know, senator vows to protect girl until he learns that she's trans and runs away. And that's exactly what happened. You know, and I had corroborated the story with people that were there, that secondhand accounts of what happened. There's a picture of him kneeling down in front of this little girl. And come to find out, that's exactly what he did. He knelt down, said, you know, I'm doing this. I'm bringing these bills to protect little girls like you. And then her mom says, you know, she's trans, right? What are you going to do? How are you going to protect her? And he gets up, starts backing away. And they have like a little discussion real quick, a back and forth about how, like, are you going to make her go into the boys' bathroom? And he goes, you're attacking me, and just sort of like jets off quickly. And so, yeah, that was a story that, you know, we've heard in my reporting. I've heard similar stories to this before in terms of like it going negatively with like bathrooms and stuff. But this was a case of, like, I think showcasing the humanity that's there. Like, this senator saw her and knew that, like, this kid needed protecting, regardless of, like, what he thought. And it wasn't until, you know, he had to reframe it whenever he learned about her identity that suddenly changed.
Yeah. Did any national media or anyone else in Atlanta or anything like that pick up on it?
Yeah. I don't know about Atlanta. I know that The Advocate picked up on it. I know that a number of other news organizations picked up on it. I know that the person who I was reporting on, the mom, said that, like, she was speaking to a ton of news people. So that happened very quickly. But that story got a lot of press. Like, it picked up and got a lot of steam. I know that she, for the next, like, week or two after I reported on it, said that many people were reaching out to her. I'll also say that I just got word, and I need to confirm it, but I just got word that that bill didn't pass. It didn't go forward, the bill that they were there on. And so, you know, we see this a lot, and you know, a lot of these bills are going to pass, and no matter how you report on them, they're going to pass. But sometimes whenever you shine the light on them, especially in an embarrassing way like that, they back away. And that's something that I've seen numerous occasions.
Yeah. And then the next step in this is that you do a lot of legislative coverage, as you said. And I have a few examples from the last few months. I'm just going to read them just to show people what we're talking about here. There was a Wyoming House bill that could take trans kids from their parents. Another Georgia hearing on LGBTQ curriculum in schools that only allowed anti-trans proponents to speak. And then Idaho's House committee passed a LGBTQ plus book ban on Martin Luther King Day. Another, and there's a whole bunch here, a bill in South Carolina, a subcommittee hearing regarding anti-transgender legislation, where one of the Republican legislators asked a witness for copies of the results of studies cited by activists, and the activist pulled out a binder that had a couple of hundred pages in it. They were ready for that. Just fascinating. A Utah bill headed to the state Senate that would charge transgender people with a crime if they used the bathroom, of their gender identity. What's it like to watch a legislative hearing or read through some of the legislation? Like, what's it like for you as you do that?
Yeah, you know, this is, I think, one of the things where this is why I often get invited to go speak on, like, NPR or speak with Washington Post, because honestly, very few people have read as many of these bills as I've read. And I would wager to say that nobody has watched as many hours of legislative hearings on this topic than myself. And so for me, it's surreal, because what I see in these hearings is, you know, at this point, watching a hearing, it becomes like a set of just like puzzle pieces that continue to pop in from hearing to hearing to hearing to hearing. And it's just all about how the senators or the legislators are going to put them together. You hear the exact same points made in each hearing. You hear the exact same information. You can see sort of like the way in which they will not speak on bills, for instance. I mean, like there are themes that pop in every single hearing. I'll give you a few. One of the themes is that I see in hearings is that Republican legislators will often not speak at the hearings. And in virtually like 90% of the hearings that I've watched, only a single Republican legislator will speak and all of the Democratic legislators will speak. I have reasons to believe why that is the case. I've spoken to some of the Republican legislators actually on background and learned that, you know, a lot of times they don't support these bills, but they know that they have to vote them anyway in order to not get primaried. And so what you'll often see is they're not going to put their weight behind it, but they're going to go ahead and deliver the vote because that's what they're being told to do. Another thing that we often see is that the amount of people that come out to speak against the bills is almost always 5 to 10 times higher than the amount of people that speak for them. I've seen that number go up all the way to about 20 times. We just saw that in a bill in South Carolina. Was it South Carolina? It might have been Kansas. There was a bill recently that was 500 spoke against, or 500 registered to speak against, and like 30 registered to speak in favor. That is a very, very common spread. I've seen that pop up in place to place to place. Now, what I will say, and this is sort of something that I do gain from watching all these hearings, I gain a lot. I get to see very human moments where the trans kids themselves will speak, where trans people will speak, things that make this feel very human. Another thing that I often see is how the sort of the language of the bills change. And like, I usually get the first insight into what the new bill is going to be. Like, if there's a new kind of bill that moves around the United States, I get the first insight into that. And I'll explain. If I read a gender affirming care ban, and I'm reading all the gender affirming care ban legislation, and I see that they suddenly have a new line in there in one of the states, I know that these bills, they're all copy and paste from one another. They look the same. Like, I can scan and they look the exact same. If I see something that's different, I know that, okay, this is now something that they're going to focus on in the future. So for instance, for a long time, we never saw anything about adults. Like, we never saw anything about adults at all. I started seeing this last year, they started adding two provisions on adults. They added one targeting incarcerated trans adults, so people that are in jail, basically banning their care. But also they started banning Medicaid for any age. And we just saw that in South Carolina today. And so, you know, I can get early warnings on what's going to happen with these bills as they move forward.
And it's kind of like you're part of the job, it sounds like, is detective in addition to reporting. So what are some of the things that you do on a daily basis to keep track of legislation and the things that you're writing about?
Absolutely. So at first, whenever I started doing this, it was just me. I was doing everything. And it still feels that way sometimes. I still do a lot. But I'm going to not say that. I'm going to say that actually now I'm part of a team in a way. Like, and you know, I have an intern that has helped me with some things. I have a group of people that do their own work that we all kind of track together. We raise alarm whenever we see something that looks dangerous. We try to keep track of the biggest news stories if there's like a news break. Like just today, I learned from one of the people who I work with about the Attorney General Ken Paxton thing, where he's subpoenaing PFLAG, the Parents and Family of Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, LGBTQ people, basically subpoenaing for membership lists. And so this is like a really big deal, and it's something that I've hit on before whenever he's previously issued subpoenas. But you know, it's kind of, we've got good, like we all work together. We all can send information to each other. And again, I also, it's not just like a team that I work with. I also have contacts in every state. And so whenever, you know, I've got good relationships with a lot of people in a lot of different states. And whenever something bad is going to happen, I know that like, I'm going to get emails about it. People are going to send me emails about it. So that's very helpful. And in terms of tracking, you know, I've got a legislative tracker that I've been continually updating with a few other people. One of the people on my team has built a bot that will essentially automatically refill or fill the information in on any bill that I put in there. I track the calendars for the hearings. Like I'm always looking at which hearings are going to be up this week. I mean, whenever I said earlier that like sometimes this is a job that goes till 2 a.m. A lot of times what I find myself doing is at 12, 1 in the morning, I am loading up the LegiScan page to find all of the hearings that are going to be scheduled for the next day. Because unfortunately, a lot of times these legislators don't want any attention on their hearings since they won't release them until the day before.
Yep. And it all sounds like a crazy, this is borrowing a John Oliverism more or less, but it sounds like a crazy freaking way to run a government with the way that all these things are done. And speaking of him, am I right that when you look at things from a national perspective, that John Oliver is one of the better reporters or has done a better job reporting on transgender issues than most other national reporters?
Absolutely. I remember watching John Oliver's big special on trans issues, and I know some of the people that he brought on. Like I know Deb Jackson, for instance. She's amazing. And I think that John Oliver has treated this issue extremely well. And I think that, you know, it's hard to find good coverage on trans issues. Right now, whenever we see national media outlets like the New York Times essentially, you know, getting so much wrong about coverage, and we also have so few trans journalists, especially at major institutions that are able to cover this issue, it's hard to find examples of good coverage. And John Oliver, even John Stewart had a really good coverage as well. So both the Johns.
Yeah.
Have done really well on this.
What are the things that mainstream media most commonly get wrong?
You know, I think that whenever it comes to mainstream media, what we often see right now is that, you know, there's some very basic journalistic fact-checking practices that are just not being followed. One of the issues that we see often is that outlets will print quotes from organizations that are opposed to trans care and not fact check them. And they, you know, they're just printing the quote, but like, if you're going to print a quote that sounds authoritative from a group, you can't just leave it there because your readers are going to think that you have fact checked that quote. Your readers are going to think that that is a true statement about care. So you often see things like autism causes being trans, says the Society for Anti-Trans Laws or something, you know, and like people will read that and they won't understand that, like, okay, this is actually a very fringe medical opinion. And the APA just put out a statement literally yesterday saying that there's no evidence for this. And so we often see a lack of fact checking, a lack of fact checking the quotes, especially. Another thing that we often see is that, you know, for whatever reason, it seems like we are missing trans editors, trans journalists covering topics. And I know actually from speaking to some of them who will remain unnamed, that some major outlets will not let trans people cover trans issues. And it, you know, it's unfortunate that that's the case, but many times these issues are being covered by a select few cisgender journalists who are more than willing to get things really, really wrong. And, you know, we've seen this especially in the New York Times. Just recently, we saw the Pamela Paul piece where 4,500 words were devoted towards basically anti-trans coverage. And it was posted in the opinion section, but by God, it looked like an investigative journalist piece. And it had the feel of that. It didn't have the feel of an opinion piece whenever you read it. And yet there were so many things that just got fundamentally wrong about trans care, including relying on a retracted article at one point. And, you know, these are things that you would expect basic fact checking processes to sort of flag, and yet that didn't happen.
What are some of the stories that you've done that you're most proud of?
This is a really good question. And I think for me, it's the stories where I'm able to basically take what people like the good news stories of resistance and spread them around. And also to raise awareness of people whose stories were perhaps tragically never going to be told. One of the stories that I'm really proud of is Eden Knight's story. This was a Saudi Arabian, basically refugee, who was living in America. She was a transgender girl, and she was, you know, her friends had messaged me with a really wild story telling me about how she was tricked into getting on a plane back to Saudi Arabia, and she was essentially trafficked back to Saudi Arabia, and she took her life in Saudi Arabia. And it also turned out that she was like the daughter of like a very high ranking Saudi official there. And number one, nobody wanted to report on this story because it can be scary as a journalist to report on the Saudi Arabian government. You know, we have a history of like what happens with that. And this was the daughter of a very high ranking, you know, had ties to the royal family in Saudi Arabia. So that automatically made it much harder for them to get the story out. And then the second thing was that, you know, there were American people who worked to traffic her out, like people that are still licensed to practice law in the United States that, you know, sort of denied her access to her friends and her medical care. And so I heard them out. I reported on the story. I did some fact checking. They sent me pictures. They sent me information about her. And within a day of publishing it, the news got out and other major outlets picked it up. The Rolling Stone picked it up. Washington Post picked it up. And Eden Knight's story became well known, like to a lot of people. And I think that for me, I've realized since that story, but in so many other instances, that I occupy a space now to where maybe I don't get to tell our stories in the New York Times or the Washington Post, although I have started contributing to The Guardian. But enough journalists follow my work that if I report on something, chances are it's going to get reported on within 24 hours by a number of other outlets. So that story is one that I'm proud of. I'm also proud of my legislative map. That's something that I've been doing for a while now. I have been tracking all of the risk levels for each state for legislation. And I started doing this because families have been asking me about like where to go and how safe their home state is and if they should leave. And I was able to start mapping things out, and people have been making really big decisions based on that map. And they've been thanking me for releasing that map. I'll give you some examples. There have been Fortune 500 companies that have that have decided not to hold conferences in states that are extremely unsafe for trans people because they know that they've got trans employees. There are family members who are helping their kids go to college in states that are safer. That way they know that they're not going to get targeted whenever they move. And you know, so that one's another big one. And then the last one is a more recent one. And that was my piece that was essentially a response to the Pamela Paul piece, the debunking piece on the New York Times Pamela Paul story, 4,500 pages, words long. And I lucked out on that one because I had read her story within, you know, 30, 45 minutes of it coming out. And as I read it, I knew two things. I knew, number one, that this would be like one of their big stories they were going to try to push really hard. I've developed this sixth sense for that. And number two, I also knew that it was regurgitating so many things that have been repeatedly contradicted through science, through peer-reviewed research, through all the major medical organizations, that it would be very easy to go through and fact check it. And so immediately, it was like on a Saturday, like I immediately went to work and I picked four things from the article that I knew that I could write very extensively about, that I had already written very extensively about. I did my usual, like I fact checked, I took a screenshot of the article itself, the New York Times article, threw it, and then put a big fact check red bar on it, which that's become, I think, one of my things that I do, and people know to look out for those because a lot of times they don't know how to deal with these sort of like incorrect information that goes viral. I published it. And immediately upon publishing it, it went viral. I ended up getting, you know, a good 4 million views on that article on varying platforms. And that was, you know, whenever I messaged the New York Times asking like, hey, I want to be able to respond to your article, because she's continuing to, she even like responded to me in a way that didn't respond to the article. They basically said that like, you know, no, you've already got a response here. Like people are already reading it. So I was glad to be able to do that. I think it's made an impact.
That's all right. So that's amazing. 4 million. What do you get in terms of reader response from the positive side and from the negative side?
Yeah. So from the positive side, I've got a very dedicated reader base that really depends on me for the information that I put out there. And they also are very good about giving me information. They're very good about letting me know, you know, what's going on in their own home state. And so I think that like, if I want to speak, I just did this earlier. If I want to speak to somebody at the American Psychological Association, I can jump onto my Substack chat and have somebody from the APA within minutes. And so like, that's been something that I've been very well connected to my reader, to my audience, and they're well connected to me. Like we've got a good dialogue that we're constantly engaging in. In terms of negative, you know, I have not had negativity from my readers themselves. The negativity tends to come from the people who have consistently relied on a media ecosystem that has allowed them to put misinformation on care out into the general public, and who see my work and, you know, I think accurately view it as a threat to that disinformation. And so I've had my work, you know, cast aside before as like, oh, she's just an activist, or oh, she's just somebody who you shouldn't listen to. And I think that, you know, I let my work speak for itself. I've gotten enough news into the Rolling Stone, into the Washington Post, into the New York Times and the Associated Press at this point that like my reporting stands for itself and I stand behind it.
Yeah, I was going to say that, you know, this is 2024. It's a different time from 10, 20, 30 years ago. And you could be defined as both journalist and activist. And I was curious for your take on where you view the line between the two.
This is a really good point. And, you know, what I will say is that the advent of very modern, we have to seek a middle ground that doesn't always exist sort of journalism, where you're trying to say that literally every issue that's out there is a compromised middle ground position and that's where the truth lies. I don't necessarily think that that's the case. I think that in some cases you can report on truth that does not swing in one direction or towards the middle ground. Another thing that I will say is that originally, like if you go back into the history of journalism, you go back into like the 1700s, 1800s, you'll see that the original journalism was also part of activism. You're using information and truth to make a point. And I try to do that as well. Another thing that I'll mention too is that I'm not reporting, you know, I am reporting as a member of my community, and I've got our stories to tell. And while sometimes those stories might make an important point, or they might aid in the beating of legislation, I'll also say that, like, I feel very strongly that I've got a commitment to the truth. And if I get something wrong, like if I get a fact wrong, I will correct it. And I maintain that, like, anybody can message me if they see that I've gotten anything in error. They can do that. I've changed things before. I'll note that I changed it. I do follow basic journalistic guidelines and practices. And the other thing too is that, like, I seek out experts whenever I'm reporting on something. I've got medical experts that I can speak to if I'm reporting on trans care. I've got local activists that I can speak to if I'm reporting on what a bill will do. And so, you know, it, again, to just circle back around, I do wear both hats sometimes, and I try to make it so that these two aspects of what I do are not in competition with one another, but rather they aid in what I do, in the sense that I can see which stories are not being told. And in some ways, truth can become activism in and of itself whenever we tell those stories.
Sure. You wrote one thing that you didn't mention among the pieces that you were proud of. You wrote about your engagement to Zoe Zephyr, the state representative from Montana. What was that like to write about?
Oh, it was wonderful. And, you know, it was the wild thing about that piece. And yeah, I was literally just in my wedding planning meeting just now, by the way. So, like, you're catching me at whenever I'm, like, riding a high on that. Is that Representative Zoe Zephyr, she's, you know, the first trans rep in Montana. I had been, before everything happened with her, I, like, this was part of my beat. I was reporting on things that happened in Montana, trans issues in Montana, just like in every other state. And so I got to, you know, I witnessed what went down in Montana, where, you know, she was silenced for speaking on a gender affirming care ban. They denied her the ability to speak, violating all rules in the Montana House of Representatives, and basically denied all of her constituents representation. I very quickly found myself in the position to where I was reporting on a very important development in trans news that was also my girlfriend at the time. And that was a wild event. And so then I flew in to Montana just to be with her. And she proposed to me at queer prom while, like, this was in the middle of all this going on. And it was, number one, it was just an amazing moment because it was a beautiful proposal. And number two, it became a really good, I think, event for me to, like, tell a personal story about Zoe. Because all the other stories that were coming out about what was going on in Montana was about the political fight there and the fight for representation, fight for democracy. But nobody really knew her the way that I knew her. And to be able to tell that story through our own love, through our own relationship, and through that proposal, that is a story that I was very proud of.
I like talking to journalists when they do personal essays. Their faces tend to change, and their voices tend to change, as yours did there. And I appreciate that you were able to share a story of trans joy. How do you manage your mental health?
It's a really good question. And it's hard. Like, I'm not going to pretend like I am just, like, swimming in positivity all the time. Like, especially those nights where you have to stay up late, you have to wake up early, and you have to witness the most depraved things said about people like you. That said, I've got an amazing woman by my side. I've got an amazing 8-year-old kid. I find time and space to just decompress with them. I have things that I do to maintain my mental health. I like going outdoors. I like hiking. If I can escape into nature, I'm telling you, one of the best things for my mind is being in a place to where my phone does not work. And I try to find myself in those spaces as often as physically possible, which is not very often given the work that I do. But whenever I can do that, it helps me sort of reconnect and reground myself with the world around me. Other than that, you know, I think that even in the hard times, whenever I can't disconnect and where I have to stay on top of breaking news, I'm always being sent messages from trans kids, from the parents of trans kids, from trans adults who are coming out to their family, who constantly tell me that they use my resources to help get acceptance, to help show their mom what's going on, to help show their company why they can't go to Florida, to help fight for healthcare benefits to help them learn that they can also run for elected office. And I think that, like, witnessing the constant stream of people who I do get to help, that makes the hard times easier.
I have one practical question before we wrap up. Substack, you're on a Substack, it's a newsletter, you're an independent journalist. There are a lot of challenges to doing that. Is something like this financially viable?
Yeah. I mean, like, now I will say that it's financially viable, extremely financially viable, but it's also something that, like, you've got to become a trusted voice in something. And for me, I have found my space. I have found the thing that I can talk about that a lot of people want to hear about. And I'm glad that a lot of people want to hear about it. I am able to support myself, thankfully. And I think that, you know, I often say that there is still room here for this work. I, whenever I'm choosing a hearing to watch, I am missing 9 other hearings. And there are so many more stories to be told from our community. I know others are doing this work. I know, you know, for instance, Evan Urquhart is doing an amazing job at Assigned Media. Carly Webb. There's a few really good journalists that are out there doing this work. And I'm always, always calling for more.
I was just about to say that the show is called The Journalism Salute. We salute you for your good work, and we ask that you do likewise. Can you tell us a little bit more about those that you mentioned, or journalism organizations? You can do more than one that you would like to salute for their good work to wrap up the show.
Yeah, absolutely. So the first thing I will say is Evan Urquhart at Assigned Media is doing an amazing job. I think that he is doing sort of what I was doing back whenever I had first launched my newsletter, and he's very quickly gaining recognition. And he also does not blur the line between journalists and activists as much as I do, which has its own space, and I respect that. And so, you know, Evan Urquhart is doing amazing work. Carly Webb at OutSports has covered sports issues with an incredible, like, deftness, and she's just, her coverage is top notch. And then also, I will always recommend the Trans Journalists Association. They are a really good organization that sort of puts out information about how to cover trans topics. There are, you know, hundreds of trans journalists and people who work in the journalism industry. And that's a really great sort of space for interfacing with trans journalists and for finding information on covering trans issues.
Erin Reed, www.erinthemorning.com. You can follow her newsletter. You can find her on Twitter. You can find her on all the different social media platforms, videos on Instagram and TikTok as well. Thank you for giving us the time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Journalism Salute. Please let us know what you think of the show. You can find us on Twitter at JournalismPod, and you can email us at JournalismSalute@gmail.com.